Thanks for joining us on the JX today. We start by casting our gaze upon the Pacific Ocean, with our attention focused on the forests of kelp, or what's left of them. Kelp forests have had a hard time in recent years, and now research shows that the lack of kelp has a ripple effect up the food chain, all the way to gray whales. Less kelp appears to mean less zooplankton, so less food for whales. The research is out of Oregon State University. The lead researcher is Lisa Hildebrand, a PhD candidate in the Geospatial Ecology of Marine Megafauna, or GEM Lab, at the Marine Mammal Institute at Oregon State University. Lisa Hildebrand, thanks for joining us on the Jefferson Exchange.
Thanks for having me.
We have talked about the subject a few times before, but a little catch-up is always helpful here. Give us an idea of the overall importance of kelp forests and what's been happening to them on the West Coast.
So kelp are a tremendously valuable habitat in the nearshore environment off our Oregon coast and the greater Pacific Northwest. For a number of different reasons, and specifically for the zooplankton, which are sort of the prey base for a lot of the upper trophic levels in the nearshore ecosystem, we believe that kelp provides a number of things to these zooplankton. They may provide shelter from predators or from ocean currents. They provide nutrients, as kelp forests are really good at retaining nutrients within their kelp fronds. And so we think that zooplankton, really like these kelp forests in our nearshore environment, and we found this correlation between more kelp in better kelp condition results in more zooplankton abundance in the nearshore on the Oregon coast.
And so what's been happening to kelp forests in recent years?
Kelp has had kind of a tough time along the southern Oregon coast and northern California coastline too, actually. And it all starts with sunflower sea stars, actually. So sunflower sea stars are the only predator of sea urchins in the Oregon waters, since we don't have sea otters. And what happened in 2013 was something called sea star wasting syndrome, which decimated populations of sunflower sea stars all up and down the Pacific Northwest coastline, including in southern Oregon, where 100% of the sunflower sea star population was decimated. This happened sort of at the same time as the strong marine heat wave, also known as the blob, which started in 2014. So those two things together, this sort of very warm water during the marine heat wave and the loss of the sunflower sea star, sort of created a perfect storm for sea urchin populations to boom, essentially, on the southern Oregon coast, because they didn't have a predator that was keeping them in check. And the warm water is really detrimental to kelp growth. And so with less kelp for the urchins to passively feed on, they started switching to active feeding on the kelp. And so, it was really these two things happening together, the loss of the predator and warm waters, that created this perfect sea urchin storm.
Are the sea urchins then just going to continue munching on the kelp until there's no kelp left?
Yeah, essentially. They sea urchins are invertebrates, and so they're, they can reproduce pretty rapidly and in large numbers. And if they have a food source and no one to keep them in check, then their populations really can, increase quite rapidly.
Do we have good numbers on the reduction in kelp forests that's resulted in space and in time?
We do from our study. So our study in Port Orford along the southern Oregon coast did cover a relatively small spatial scale, but these, relationships between sea urchins and kelp have been documented for decades in ecological studies, that if sea urchins, for whatever reason, are no longer being controlled top down by a predator, then they will start behaving more voraciously. They'll start grazing directly on the kelp, and kelp abundance, population, and health will all decline as a result of that. And so while that's been documented, throughout time in many different places around the world, what we found in southern Oregon is that those two dynamics happening then caused zooplankton populations to decline as a result.
We're talking to Lisa Hildebrand, a PhD candidate at Oregon State University's Marine Mammal Institute, specifically in the Geospatial Ecology of Marine Megafauna Lab, GEM Lab, about whales and the effects of the lack of kelp on the Oregon coast on whale populations because of the trophic effects up the food chain. So what specifically did you go looking for? I mean, it sounds like you had some idea that this was happening in recent years, and how did you put it together into coherent research?
So we've had this, the GEM Lab has had this research study on gray whales and their prey ongoing now. We're going into our 10th year this year in 2024, which is really incredible to have such a long-term study going on, you know, a marine mammal. But so when we started this research in 2016, we were really mostly interested in figuring out what are Pacific Coast Feeding Group gray whales feeding on here in Oregon. How are they able to sort of prioritize quantity versus quality of prey? So we were asking very different questions than what we were addressing in this study. But part of that research is that we go out on a tandem research kayak to set sampling stations in the nearshore environment, and we drop a GoPro camera. And we do that to film the amount of prey that is in the water column. And it was in the third year of our study in 2018 when one of our undergraduate interns that was helping with fieldwork for that season noticed these really dramatic images of purple sea urchins decimating kelp plants. You know, we were seeing a lot of kelp that had no fronds left. The stalks were looking very chewed down, very short. And it was these images that sort of prompted us to start, you know, diving deeper and looking into, well, what does this mean? Is this happening at a larger scale? Is it happening across time? When did this start? And what are the potential impacts up to the gray whales? Because what we had documented up until then is that the gray whales really did seem to like foraging in the kelp or really close to the kelp. So we were interested in seeing, well, could these dramatic images of the urchins and the kelp, could that in some way, you know, trickle up words to the gray whales.
Is that unusual behavior for a gray whale, or you know, does it happen where gray whales are, or do we know?
That is a really great question. So here in the eastern North Pacific Ocean, we have a population of gray whales that is also named the eastern North Pacific population. And the majority of these whales, they migrate from their breeding lagoons in Baja California, Mexico, up to feeding grounds in the Bering and Chukchi Seas, so up in the Arctic. And these whales primarily feed benthically. So they will dive down to the seafloor and they actually scoop up mud and sediment and filter that for their prey. But the whales that we're studying here off the southern coast of Oregon is a subgroup of that population, and that subgroup is called the Pacific Coast Feeding Group. And they're unique because of instead of migrating all the way to the Arctic to feed, what this group of about 200 whales does is that they stick around the coastlines between Northern California and Southern British Columbia. And in these waters, these Pacific Coast Feeding Group gray whales are feeding using a number of different behavioral tactics. So we see them not only doing this sort of benthic sediment feeding, but we see something that we have termed headstanding, and it sounds exactly, it is exactly the way it sounds. The whales are standing on their heads, essentially, with their fluke, you know, beating at the surface to try and keep their head down. And we see this behavior a lot in these rocky, reefy, kelpy environments along, you know, the Oregon coast, but it's also been seen by researchers up in Washington and in British Columbia.
That's interesting. So these whales don't go to the Bering and Chukchi Seas. And we have talked about previous studies that showed issues with gray whales getting food, the ones that do go to the Arctic, but these don't even go to the Arctic and are having problems finding food.
Yes, they do not. So we do think that there's, you know, there's different environmental changes that regulate the prey and therefore potentially the whale populations between the whales that go to the Arctic and the whales that stay here. What I will say is that what we documented in our study here off the Oregon coast is probably at the moment happening at a very small localized scale. So these complex trophic interactions where we saw, you know, the loss of kelp forest because of an increase in urchins, probably as a result of the loss of the sunflower sea star predator and the warm waters, that probably wasn't happening all up and down the Pacific Northwest coastline where these Pacific Coast Feeding Group gray whales feed, because in other areas where the sunflower sea star was killed off by the sea star wasting syndrome disease, there were probably sea otters that were still able to keep the sea urchins in check. So even when tough environmental conditions like the marine heat wave were maybe impacting the kelp and causing that to not grow as abundantly, there was still sort of that safety net of the sea otter that was able to keep the sea urchin populations in check.
We're talking about kelp and whales and food here in the Jefferson Exchange with Lisa Hildebrand from the GEM Lab, which is the Geospatial Ecology of Marine Megafauna Lab at the Marine Mammal Institute, Oregon State University, the lead author on recently published research about effects of what's going on with the kelp forests on whale food. I haven't asked about benthic feeding. When you say that, what does that mean?
Benthic, we use the word benthos essentially to describe the bottom of the ocean, the seafloor. So gray whales are, just as a species, are sort of uniquely adapted and different to other baleen whale species, where they will feed along the seafloor, and they evolved to do this tactic where they dive down to the bottom of the ocean, and they're doing this in relatively shallow waters, so sort of, 60 to 80 meters is where they're feeding in the Arctic. So they dive to the bottom and they scoop up sediment, and that's what they're filtering. That's what I mean when I talk about benthic feeding.
Okay, I appreciate the explainer there. So let's talk about prospects in the 3 minutes or so we have left here. I mean, what is the current status of the sea stars and therefore the kelp forests as well?
So up and down the Pacific Northwest coast, we are hearing reports that sunflower sea stars are recovering. You know, people who go diving are seeing baby and juvenile sunflower sea stars sort of popping up in regions where they haven't been seen for a long time. So that gives us hope. We also, in the final year of the study that we published in Nature Scientific Reports, in the eighth year, we started to see sort of a slow uptick in the kelp condition in our study area. We started to see an uptick in the zooplankton abundance, and we did see whales feeding a little more than we had in the previous years. So I think what we hope we're seeing is sort of a local recovery of these conditions that we documented. And what's really great is that, these nearshore ecosystems, they are resilient, and we are seeing, bounce backs from these really tough environmental conditions and these tough trophic interactions. So we're hopeful that things are sort of on the uptick. As I mentioned earlier, we are going back for another field season this year, so we will continue to monitor all of these different trophic levels from the kelp to the urchins to the zooplankton all the way up to the gray whales.
Well, let's not leave otters out of this. I know we've talked about the prospects for sea otter reintroduction in Oregon. That's a long and tricky process, isn't it?
It sure is. There's a lot of things that need to be considered when, wanting to reintroduce a species into an ecosystem.
You know, when you were talking about the GoPro that was put down there and that there was a student working on the project, it just sort of kind of summed up for me what science tends to be. You make an observation and then go, hey, what's happening there?
Absolutely. And it's one of the things that I feel so proud of with this project. It's a little unique in the sense that we don't just prioritize the science that we're and the data that we're collecting, but it's really centered on providing high school and undergraduate students with experiential learning. And so we, as a team of 4 to 5 people, we go down to Port Orford for 6 weeks every year of the summer. And we train high school and undergraduate students a bunch of different fieldwork methods, data processing methods, and you really see the growth in the students that have come through the program, you know, from start to finish. Students asking, you know, complex ecological questions and making observations and, yeah, being part of the scientific process. And it's really what makes my heart swell about this project, is being able to sort of be part of that journey of students who are, you know, discovering science, discovering ecology.
So you don't have to be a PhD level person to make discoveries in science. That is clear from this. A lot of information that can prove helpful, I think, about what we know about kelp and whales and the interactions thereof. The article published in late April in Nature Scientific Reports. Lisa Hildebrand is the lead author, along with Lee Torres, Céline Derville, and Inez Hildebrand. That's Lisa's mother. At the GEM Lab, the Geospatial Ecology of Marine Megafauna Lab at the Marine Mammal Institute, Oregon State University. Lisa Hildebrand, thank you so much.
Thanks so much for having me.
You bet. This is the Jefferson Exchange. We'll be back.